But I want to take in one big gulp today the period from 100 to 325 A.D. Now, I apologize, it's not my custom, but I'm going to do the best I can. However, in starting this period, I want to quote you from an early church document known as the Epistle to Diognetus. I want to read to you from it, if I have your permission. The Christians, this is a contemporary document from about the year 125-150. The Christians are distinguished from other men by country, by language. The Christians are not distinguished from other men by country, by language, or by civil institutions. For they neither dwell in cities by themselves, nor use a peculiar tongue, nor lead a singular mode of life. They dwell in the Grecian and the barbarian cities, as the case may be. But they follow the usage or the custom of the country in dress, food, and other such affairs of life. Yet, they present a wonderful and a confessedly paradoxical conduct. They dwell in their own native land, but as strangers. They take part in all things as citizens, and they suffer all things as foreigners. Every foreign country is a fatherland to them, and every nation, native land, is a foreign land to them. They marry, like all others. They have children. But they do not cast away their offspring. They have the table in common, but not their wives. They live upon the earth. They are citizens of heaven. They obey the existing laws and excel the laws by their lives. They live and are persecuted by all. They are unknown, and yet they are condemned. They are killed and made alive. They are poor and make many rich. They lack all things, and yet in all things they abound. They are reproached and glory in their reproaches. They are calumniated and are justified. They are cursed and they bless. They receive scorn and they give honor. They do good and are punished as evildoers. When punished, they rejoice at being made alive. By the Jews they are attacked as aliens, and by the Greeks they are persecuted. And the cause of the enemy, their enemies cannot tell you. In short, what the soul is in the body, the Christians are in the world. The soul is diffused at all members of the body, and the Christians are spread throughout the cities of the world. The soul dwells in the body, but it is not of the body. So the Christian dwells in the world, but they are not of the world. The soul, invisible, keeps watch in the visible body. So also the Christians are seen to live in the world. But their piety is invisible. The flesh hates and wars against the soul, suffering no wrong from it. But because it resists fleshly pleasures, and the world hates the Christians with no reason, but that they resist its pleasures. The soul loves the flesh and the members by which it is hated. So the Christians live they love their haters. The soul is enclosed in the body, but holds the body together. So the Christians are detained in the world as a prison, but they contain the world. Immortal, the soul dwells in a mortal body. So the Christian dwells in corruptible society, but they look for incorruption in the heavens. The soul is the better for restriction on food and drink, and the Christians increase daily, although punished. Their lot God has assigned to them in the world, but the world cannot take it from them. Isn't that tremendous testimony? That was written by a contemporary. It's not written by a modern who looks back. It was written by a Roman who was looking on the Christian. This is when they described the throne of the lions. Now, last time I dwelt upon the early church with you. Today, among other topics, the first great topic I'd like to continue to consider with you is what made the gospel spread. When you think that it started out as a very peculiar group, namely the Jews, by the year 70, the temple had been destroyed, and now the Roman world knew that the Christians were not Jews, but they were new religion. But they were a small group. We don't know exactly how many. We know that on one occasion 5,000 were converted in the book of Acts, another occasion 4,000 were converted, and we read of conversions throughout the missionary journeys of Paul. It has been estimated, and I grant you, this is no Gallup poll, that by the year 100, there probably might have been in the all of Roman Empire about 100,000 Christians. By 311 AD, the time of Constantine, they were a force that had to be reckoned with. Now, that's a period of about 211 years. What brought this about? Why did the church spread so? Well, this quotation I gave you gives some of the reasons. Christianity had and has an intrinsic worth. I'm not going to ask you, gentlemen, I have no intention of embarrassing you, but of the outward conditions, what brought you to the Lord? Now, you had been discussing some of the situations you faced out there in San Francisco, and I have an idea, but I've known Fernando now for a little over a year, summer of 1983. And I do not know. He just told me a little while ago he was converted 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to ask you any questions. I can't help but wonder what brought you to the Lord. Now, I know Johnny Lynch was the human agency. At least I assume that's the case. Was he?
No. The Bible itself.
Okay. I know a missionary who's a very close friend of his. He and, Johnny Lynch and his wife. And I know that you're close friends now. And I had assumed that Johnny Lynch had been the agent. I was wrong. I'm not going to ask you. It's none of my business, really. But I don't think that's my role to ask you those private affairs, unless you want to say it. But
I'm going to say it.
All right, go ahead.
Well, I became Christian about 7 years ago. I was raised in the church. I wasn't a Christian. I was influenced by a girl at work. And I was very worldly.
Well,
myself a self-made man.
Uh-huh. Well, she had a great testimony, did her. I don't know her, of course. One time when I was in Colorado teaching in the Young Life Graduate School, a friend of mine had me to dinner at the Home of the Navigators, which is an old medieval castle out there. Have you seen it? Well, and they had some interesting people there, and they placed me next to a young lady. Oh, let's say, in a dinner about, say, 25, 26. And I got talking to her, and she was a Christian. And I knew she was from England. I could tell that by her accent. And she said, "You're from North Carolina." I'm not going to deny that fact. Anyway, she went on, and I said to her, "How did you become a Christian?" I was sort of nosy, I guess. And she said, "Do you really want to know?" I said, "Yeah, I'm not interested." She said, "I sat down one day and read the book of Nahum in the Old Testament." Now, that girl had been secretary to the Young Communist League in England. She was a flaming, ardent communist. And she picked up the Old Testament book of Nahum. Now, she was a graduate of the University of London. I said, "Well, now, of all the books in the Bible, I must admit I'm curious as to why you picked the book of Nahum." Well, she said, "First of all, the Lord directed my eyes to it." Well, I wasn't going to argue that point. But I said, "Why did he do that?" She said, "I'm a student of English literature." She majored in English literature at the University of London. She said, "Have you ever stopped to think of the fact that the English literature in the Book of Nahum is one of the most beautiful parts of Scripture?" Well, I'd read the Book of Nahum, I wouldn't know how many times. But that never hit me. Because I was not a student of English literature the way that girl was. She was smart and well-trained. But anyway, that was her experience.
Yeah. I guess I'll explain my ignorance.
Well, it's It's one of the minor prophets in the Old Testament, the back of the Old Testament. It's not the shortest book. Obadiah is the shortest book, but it comes pretty close to Bennett.
Pretty short.
Yeah. And yet, it is. I went after.
Oh, you're saying. I'm sorry.
N-A-H-U-M.
Yeah.
I went back and read it after she said that because I was curious. And I could see what she was talking about, but it had escaped my attention, you see.
Mm-hmm. What do you believe, like, the eyes of the Lord sometimes doesn't open your thoughts, your mind to that, like she was prepared to do that? Because I've done that so many times just in Ephesians.
Oh.
Go back and read it. And
Lord, I agree with you, Tom. The Lord had his own time for the effectual calling of his saints. And to a time in your personal history when outward circumstances like you, Don, or this girl, in the midst of her success being caught by them, or you and your success, so,
mm-hmm.
and you are being brought up in them to the God where he called them. Now, what I'm getting at is that one of the reasons for the spread of the gospel was what I would like to call its intrinsic worth. I don't know a better term. If you do, you're at liberty to substitute. But the gospel in the Old and New Testament has an intrinsic worth. That worth is literary, but above all, it speaks to the deepest need to man. I might tell you a story. We're originally from Winston-Salem, and I was on the site of the church there, and we had a very nice custom of having a member of the session stand at the two doors through which the people would enter the sanctuary. And now, this is what this person told me. I cannot vouch for its truth, but he told me. I was standing at the door today, because I didn't remember the incident. And this man came to the church. I'd never seen him before. I treated him like you'd treat anybody, a visitor or anybody else. I showed him to his seat, and at the end of the service, he came and he said, "I want to talk to you." I said, "Well, that'd be fine." In brief, his story was that he had walked by the church with a gun in his pocket intending to commit suicide. And to prove it, he pulled the gun out. There was no doubt about the having a gun. And he said, "But I heard the singing of the hymn." And he said, "I was just drawn in that door." And then he said, "You greeted me." And I didn't remember, but I took his word for him. And after he said, "I want to go back and talk to the pastor." He went back to talk to Pastor. As a result of that, not right that moment, but sometime shortly thereafter, he was gloriously converted. He sat and heard the sermon, and later he went before the pastor and joined, and session joined the church. Now, just to show you how the Lord works, this man had been first violinist with the National Symphony Orchestra in Washington, D.C., under Fritz Hans Kindler. No, first violinist. He was also he sold chemicals for the national lead and copper random company. Is that what it's called? Something. Well, anyway, you get this point. At the North Pole, he could have sold you refrigeration equipment and conditioning units. He could have sold you heating equipment in the South Pole and the equator done just as well. He got gloriously drunk. And the company fired him. Their sales sagged terribly. At that time, this was 1957, 57, he had a $50,000 guaranteed salary. For that day, that was a huge salary. Well, the sales went down. You know what the company did? Come on back. He went back, got gloriously drunk, and sold some customers. They fired him. Sales went down. Come on back. The third time he went back, he got drunk. In the Constitution Hall, while he was playing in the orchestra, he fell down the marble steps and broke his bowing hand. And he got in a fight with the police and a few other people. The company fired him. His wife and his daughters literally spit in the face and kicked him out of the house. How he got to Winston-Salem, I don't know. He didn't know. But he became converted. He was soundly converted. He immediately went to work, working with other alcoholics or potential alcoholics, and he could spot them like nobody's business. A funny thing happened. He took an apartment in the basement of a building uptown, And he was a chemist by trade, and he was concocting a new kind of soap for washing cars, and he was concocting it in this basement. And one night about 12 o'clock, the police called me and said, "Come uptown." I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "Well, your friend has a little problem. The machinery hadn't worked right." The main street in front of the Wachovia Bank in Trust County was flooded with soap, and the police cars were sloshing around. Of course, it wasn't a crime, but something had malfunctioned, and they wanted me to come up. He wanted me to come up. He wasn't drunk. He was perfectly sober, working feverishly to get this thing working right. But the damage had already been done. But he became a respected citizen, and one day he came to me and said, I want to meet you at the railroad station at 7:35. This on a Sunday morning. I said, "Well, Fred, it's not my custom to get up 6:30 or 6:45 on Sunday morning." I said, "What's up?" He said, "He wouldn't tell me, so I want you to meet me." At the time, the Asheville Special would come in on the route from New York City and so on into Asheville. They'd take it off the main line of Greensboro. I mean, at Winston-Salem, and put it over on the Asheville Special line. So I went down because I knew he was serious, and his wife and daughter got off the train. And the family was reunited the other day. And from that day on, he was back with his family. Now, his conversion was real and exhibited in no uncertain terms the power of the gospel. And he immediately got to work helping other alcoholics, other drunks. And I said, he was good. We had.
Well, I can sort of testify to that because I've dealt a lot with the AA, but the whole basis of the AA is power greater than yourself, and it is based around.
Well, he did a very important thing. He became head of the AA in North Carolina, and immediately he brought it under the church. And fortunately, we had a pastor then who knew how to handle things, and he became the state chaplain for the AA, and he worked very close with other pastors and the local AA group, so that it was not just a self-help deal. It became an arm of effective evangelism. And Fred Weaver was a very able fellow. Now, he still had the physical effects of the alcohol, because he'd been a real drunk, and the bowing hand never healed right. He could play the violin, but he never was first violinist against the National. But spiritually and emotionally, he was his old self before the fall into liquor. He lived out his life in a very effective Christian service. He probably was about, I'd say, 50, 52 when I first met him through this episode of the church door. Now, there's an inherent, intrinsic word in the gospel. At the same time, there was a second reason, and that was the hopeless condition of the Roman pagan world. Roman philosophy, Greek philosophy, Stoicism had had its day. Epicureanism had had its day. Platonism had its day. The heathen gods had had their day. If you read the contemporary pagan literature, you'll find that the Roman writers were complaining that people no longer worship the god. In other words, philosophically and religiously speaking, the Roman world was ready for the spread of the gospel. And when I say the Roman world, I mean the world from Mesopotamia and the borders of India and up into Britain and into North Africa, into Spain, France, because at that time, from France over to the Rhine, the Rhine-Rhone Valley, it was the Roman world. So it included almost all what we call the Western civilized world. It was philosophically and theologically accurate. Now, from Rome, Christianity spread to the other cities of the empire. And by the year 142 AD, there was a provincial synod or provincial general assembly of the church held in Italy. It was held at Telephorus in Italy. I don't need to remember that, but I mean, by that time, the church at Rome was strong. And in 225 AD, Cornelius, the Bishop of Rome, held a synod at Rome. Now, that meant that people came, or members of the ministry came from North Africa, from Marseille, from what we call today southern France, probably from Spain, because the church in Spain at that time was quite strong in a very evangelical way. And we don't know whether the Greek-speaking people came. There was, in the Roman Empire, of course, a language difficulty in that the Westerners, that is the Latin church, was not too adept at speaking Greek. And the Greek church by this time was not, shall we say, at home in the Latin. So there was not a cleave in the sense of a hostility, but I mean there was a linguistic difficulty and also the dangers of travel. The Mediterranean was infested with pirates. One of the biggest causes for the church was the lives that people led. Pliny, the younger, governor of Bithynia, wrote back to the emperor and a letter. The emperor had ordered the persecution of the Christians. Now, he wrote back and said, "What shall I do? These people love each other. Come in, please." "Good morning. It's so nice to have you with us.
My wife can't
be with us. Nice to meet you.
I don't blame you." We're talking about the reason for the spread of Christianity. I was quoting a letter from Pliny the Younger, who was a noted Roman scholar and who had been appointed governor of Bithynia. And so he wrote, he said to the emperor, what shall I do? They love each other. They're good citizens. They don't break the law. They pay their taxes. They're peace-loving. And he says, you want me to persecute them, put them dead. And Pliny was obviously confused because he said, what he's saying is, you want me to put my dead citizens to death? And Pliny was pretty much telling the emperor that he wasn't going to do it. And the emperor wrote back a postscript saying, well, now listen, in view of this fact, I'm paraphrasing. He said, if they don't cause any trouble, sort of, you know, play it along. And he said, now if they get obstreperous and try to cause trouble by evangelizing, said, first of all, give them a chance to recant. Don't just jump headlong into persecution. In other words, take it easy, boys. We can't afford to lose good citizens. Now that was a testimony to an important Roman official, Pliny the Younger. Pardon me? Hadrian. That's about the 120, as far as I can tell. You see, the dating is sometimes difficult to determine, but the dating is not important. There was a third reason. And this reason is very important. It was the persecution of the church. Nero began it. I don't know how many of you ever read the great novel Quo Vadis, Henry Sienkiewicz. Well, it's an historical novel based upon available fact, contemporary documents of the persecution of Christians. As the Roman Empire began to decline, it went into what we're having today. It went into the Panis et Circus, the bread and the circus. In other words, they had the food stamp system on the one hand, and then they entertained the Roman citizens on the other. They fed them to keep them quiet, and they entertained them to keep them quiet. This is very true. If you study Roman history, the empire was declining, and thus one way to entertain them was to have the Saturday afternoon matinee. Literally. Yeah, they fed the Christians a lion. They literally did. And they'd have so many Christians on Act 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on, so many lines. And the people loved it. I mean, see, these Christians torn together, so that's what they deserve. However, again and again and again, there was a great and glorious testimony of the Christians who were mauled to death or who were torn to pieces by the lions, so that the soul, the Romans, drunk on pleasure, drunk on wine, and drunk on sex, could only take note of what was taking place. And this had tremendous impact on the people who viewed it. We don't know how many were converted because there's no way of telling, but we do know this, that from the 100,000 or so of Christians in the year 90 or 100 A.D., maybe 150,000, to the time of Constantine, 20 years later, it was an impressive portion of the Roman Empire, so that Constantine realized, apart from anything else, that you could no longer have persecution, that you had to come to terms with it. Diocletian had tried to persecute the Christians in his reign from 285 to 304. And it had been disastrous to Diocletian because the religion which he was going to wipe out had multiplied. The church grows when it's persecuted for two reasons. It purifies the church. You know, but let me tell you, sir, when I was in the session of First Church of Winston-Salem, we had the son of a very prominent man, Winston-Salem, whose name I will dare not reveal. He'd gone off to medical school, and he came back, and he came to the session, before the session of the First Presbyterian Church, wanted to join that church. Well, he happened to live in a very fancy part of town, and there was a Presbyterian church much closer to him, much closer to his social aspirations in some ways. But he wanted to be in First Church. And so this fine old gentleman, this friend of mine, a veteran on the session, and quite a wit, asked this young doctor why he wanted to join First Church. And he said, he thought over and he thought that it would help him build his practice and it would help him to get into the Forsyth County Country Club. So this friend of mine, this veteran elder, with a perfectly straight face, he said, quote, "Mr. Moderator," addressing the pastor, "I hereby move that we recommend so-and-so to membership in the Forsyth County Country Club." that about broke up the session meeting. Now, he really said this with no intention of a spiritual reason for joining that church. And my younger son is a lawyer, is an attorney. Well, turn that thing off in Kenya. Which was aimed to get him out of political trouble, the burning of Rome. Domitian, later on that century, if you were in 81 and 96, was the first one to make the acceptance of Christianity a crime against the state. Most scholars would agree that it was Domitian who banished John the Apostle to the island of Patmos. This is not provable, but we think it is. His successor rescinded the edict and restored some peace. His successor revived the law, and made it the third great persecution. Now, here comes this letter. I mentioned this plenty. I want to read to you Trajan's reply to Pliny. "You have adopted the right course, my friend, with regard to Christians, for no universal rule is to be applied in all cases." In other words, play it cool, you know, be smart. No rule can be fixed on such matters. They should not be searched out. But when accused and convicted, they should be punished. Accused and convicted. However, yet if anyone denies that he's been a Christian, and proves it by his actions, namely by worshiping our God, he is to be pardoned upon his repentance, even though suspicion may still stay in his way. But anonymous accusations must not be admitted in any criminal process. It sets a bad example and is contrary to our law. Now, it depended upon the personality of the emperor. Hadrian, who followed Trajan, if you want the dates, 170 to 130 AD, was very mild toward the Christians. He was a mild person. And as a matter of fact, in some cases, he told overzealous proconsuls over the various times to cut it out, not to do it, to calm it down. And the persecutions went on. I'm just going to summarize this. They went on until the time I mentioned him before. His name's not from me. Diocletian. 285 to 304 AD. His was the most violent. he was determined, this was political. Diocletian was determined to make himself what today what we call a dictator. As a matter of fact, may I just make this sweeping statement? Almost all the persecutions of the Christians were not simply because they were a different religion, but because having a different religion, they would not worship the emperor. It was the underlying point was the philosophical drive toward what we call monism, to eliminate the many for the sake of the one. And that becomes a political motivation for the creation of dictatorship and the worship of the emperor. And you may remember in the prescript which Trajan had written, listen, if we worship our gods, forget it. If we worship the emperor, forget it. But Diocletian made the emperor worship absolutely necessary, and the Christians simply would not do it. So that summarizes, from the point of view of today, of what I want to say, that persecution, instead of putting the church out of order, instead of rendering it helpless, instead of having cringing Christians, brought about a heroic martyr death. Now also, the persecutions had another effect. The Christians scattered out of Rome, out of the big cities, into the countryside. And what did they do? They spread Christianity. The persecution spread the gospel, much against the intention of the Roman emperors. You see, as long as Christianity was concentrated, say, in Marseille, and in Rome, and big cities, you could fairly well control it, because you knew the governors would know who they were. But you get out in little old farms and hamlets, a little town, they didn't know, and they couldn't control it. And so you have a countryside Christianity springing up all over the place, little cell groups. Now, it may mean that the Christians in the early period, we know, met at night. They met in groves. They met in secret places, in the catacombs, in Rome. It wasn't safe to meet as a confessional group. At say 11 o'clock on Sunday mornings or any other time like that. They met when they could. But even then, we have the records that they did worship. Now, that is one of the big factors for the spread of Christianity. Not the only one. The worth of the gospel, the message of the gospel, the fact that the gospel could meet the deepest needs of the classical mind, and above all, the classical soul. That was the real reason for the spread of Christianity. It spoke to the needs of man. I'm sure that if I were to talk to you all, well, you virtually told me, at least three of you did, I'm not going to ask you, but that the gospel spoke to the deepest needs of your soul. When you wake up some night and find yourself out under the stars, you come to the conclusion there must be something better in life, you have been brought to where the Lord wants you. At that point, he supplies that. Quote unquote, something better. Or in your case, living in San Francisco and wondering why all this, and feeling a sense of frustration and sense of no purpose, I'm interpreting it correctly. Mm-hmm.
Well, living in San Francisco area.
Yeah, I knew that. I would assume that you all had come to the same period where the frustrations mattered and you suddenly see a gleam of light that you have new purpose. Now, this has been repeated in the history of the church millions of times. People in all walks of life have had that same experience. People in Paul's day, people in the year 100, as they saw the empire floating down the stream, suddenly were called, will come the later Augustine. Augustine, at the age of 17, had an illegitimate offspring. He betrayed a girl. He broke his mother's heart. And he went up to Milan to see what made this guy click. Ambrose of Milan, a great preacher. His sermon is still a great preacher. But he wasn't a believer. He went up to find out. He'd heard about Ambrose, and he was such a great orator. And Augustine wanted to be a great orator. And he went and see, well, I'm going to see this guy, you know. I'm going to hear him. And he got up there to have Ambrose preach on Easter Day, the Lord is risen. And Augustine went away a Christian man. He was converted like that because he tried Gnosticism. He tried all the isms of the day. He tried Neoplatonism. You name it. He had it. He'd been to the delicatessen. He'd gotten every sample of every religion on the market. They all failed him. But he heard Ambrose. And the new man, Augustine, walked out of that. Now, he's one of the more brilliant, well-known examples in history. But he's by no means the only one.
Well, Dr. Singh, yeah. Don't you believe in like a Christianity growth or a Christian growth, no matter where, like, say, like you wake up one morning and you say there's got to be something better than this, but like you're growing through stages and you keep growing until you're into your time.
Oh, yeah.
Or something, and you're always open, but it seems like you're always going in the road of your Christianity growth.
Yes, you are. It may be a tortuous path.
Mm-hmm.
But he who has begun a good work in you will continue to perform even until the day of Jesus Christ. I always remember, I liken this to a situation that my son and I had. When I was teaching in Colorado, I promised him on 4th of July that we would go up Pikes Peak and see the automobile races. But we got there too late and the gates had closed, there wouldn't let any more cars up. So I said, Dick, we're going to do it. So we climbed Pikes Peak on foot, and Dick would get a little bit, you know, discouraged, because how many have ever climbed Pikes Peak? I'm overwhelmed by a response. Have you climbed? Well, you know, the path goes down. You're down at the bottom. You can see that peak that went up there, and then you go up, and your path winds around, and that peak's gone, and you think, boy, where have I gone off the path? I mean, that peak ain't where it used to be. But you keep on going, and you go round and round and up and up. What do you finally do? The peak's right in front of you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You never expect to see your back.
That's right. It sticks right up. See, this is a Christian life. Not that we ever see that peak in this life, but we see peaks of it. And we get glimpses of it, and we know we're going up that trail. Well, that's the Christian experience.
Dr. Singer,
yes, sir.
You were talking about the prosecution.
Yeah.
That made Christianity spread.
Yeah.
So that goes back to the Great Commission, when you said, go and teach, and just, you spoke just to 12 disciples,
mm-hmm.
the apostles.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he spoke about the day of Pentecost, they said, you will be here till I will send my spirit.
That's right.
Power.
Quoting from John.
Right. Then, after the day of Pentecost, the church in Jerusalem was growing, but it was just getting fat. And then after the day of Stephen,
yeah.
The church spread again.
That's exactly right. You're right.
Again, the persecution was all over the place, and they had their headquarters in Antioch.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, they spread through.
That's a sort of a sub base.
Mm-hmm.
This is true. So, and I can say that the final clause of it is, was evangelism. From the very beginning, as you have well pointed out, from Jerusalem and from Antioch and then from other places, cities in the east and the west, but mostly from Rome, because Rome and Marseille were the only big cities in the west. They sent out missionaries even to England. Another Augustine went to England. Now, St. Francis Patrick was a missionary. He came over from Scotland. How he got his evangelical theology is still a mystery. Nobody really knows. But he was an evangelical. Now, the same thing took place in the East. They evangelized all the Gothic tribes. The Franks, the Vandals. Not so much the Vandals, they resisted, but later they were converted. But the Burgundians, the East Goths, the West Goths, the Franks, the Lombards, were all brought into the sway of the gospel. And the early church was a missionary church. Or I should say, an evangelistic group. But to far greater extent than we realize, it was a missionary-minded group. They had to spread the gospel. They were true to the Great Commission. Now they face great difficulties, but within the limits of those difficulties, geographical and physical. You know, when you were a missionary, then I was thinking when Dick Dye left Salisbury to go back to Acapulco, he went and got an airplane, he and his family, and when Paul went to be a missionary, he went in the Roman vessels of that day, which were rowed. You know, you didn't just go down and go to TWA to go to Africa or some other airline. In the first 4 centuries, it was very difficult. I mean, from the point of view of physical difficulty, it was dangerous. Paul's account or Luke's account of the shipwreck in Acts 27, the classic, and it's been repeated any number of times. The Sea of Galilee, it could be dangerous because of the way it's located. Topographically, winds come down, swoop up, storms there before you know it. When you have the account of Christ being the boat, remember, and the disciples scared. That happened again and again and again. And you could pose danger, a little lake like the Sea of Galilee, Gennesaret, or you could have a good old walloping storm in the Mediterranean. And not to mention pirates, but just the physical things were enough. They braved all this. Now, am I being clear to you? Curiously enough, paradoxically, the emergence of the martyrs brought with it a great danger to the church, namely the reverence or the rise or the worship of martyrs and relics. After all, they'd seen these men burned to stake, they'd seen them fed in the lions, they'd seen them thrown over cliffs, they'd seen them tormented. And after the second century, martyrdom took on a whole new meaning. It was interpreted as a purification from sin. Now, I'm not defending this, but I'm going to have to explain to you what took place in the church. If I teach you church history, I may not approve of it, but I have to explain it to you. I have to show you how the Roman church later went off badly. Now, this was not a conspiracy. Two weeks ago today, I was in Edinburgh, and I went into St. Giles Church in Edinburgh, the church of which John Knox was a pastor. I stood and put my feet on the steps to his pulpit, a great big stone pulpit looking out on that church. And I could see how, if I had been a friend, I could have elevated John Knox into being a saint. And of course, he wasn't martyred, but just to worship him because he was so great. I can understand how the church did that. I'm not condoning it, but I can understand it. Here are these men whose blood has been given for the church. And so the church, or at least sections of the church, began to ascribe to this sacrifice, this martyrdom, an atoning power to others. If you can touch the hem of the garment, quote unquote, there was an efficacy in Christian suffering which could somehow be transferred to others who would come and view the relics and so on. Tertullian said that a martyrdom must be immediately with heaven, and did not pass through anything which might be called purgatory. I mean, you had a straight through first class ticket to heaven.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there were no direct prayers to saints at this time, but there was a quote of veneration which gave them an exalted place. So it was a very easy thing to do to transfer the veneration of saints to their remains. And once this happened, it's a prolific development. Erasmus said later, at the time of the Reformation, that he had personally seen five legs of the ass upon which Jesus rode to Jerusalem, and that he had seen 12 heads of John the Baptist. To my reply, that was no wonder that that Herod was afraid of John the Baptist. He met a man with 12 heads. Now we can laugh, but there's enough wood of the true cross that's floating in Europe to build a ship out of. Because, see, the average peasant, say, living in the Rhone Valley, he couldn't tell how many bones they had of the past over in England or down in Italy. He didn't know. He thought that was the only two bones of the ass they had, you see. Or they would have a few strands of hair from the head of the Virgin Mary. They could have them all over Europe, you see. And they did. And now, because there was an efficacy, there was a curing power in these that developed. You see my point? Now, in the section down in this period down 300, this was only beginning, but it was fraught with great danger. Because once you do that, then you can venerate the martyrs, you can venerate and worship the Virgin Mary, and you can have a proliferation of relics that would swamp Europe, and they did ultimately. Please feel free to ask questions. We're a small group, and it would be delightful to have questions. Bill, do you have any questions? Please. What? You're sitting back there, but hadn't said much, Martha. Now, I want to challenge you now with a very important topic. And the important topic is this. Christianity and Catholic culture. Now you say, well, what's that? Why is that important? All right, let me point it out to you. Today, as of what? October the 13th, 1984. Yeah. You and I, as Christians, stand in a very important place. How are we to interpret not Catholic culture, but the culture of our day? How are you going to interpret not only the political campaign, but the totality of American culture? How are you going to interpret in terms of your Christian background contemporary religion? A book like Arthur Miller's The Death of a Salesman, James Joyce's works, or many modern writers, Thomas Wolfe, who can't go home again. He was North Carolinian. I'm just yanking books out of the blue. How are you going to interpret modern music, rock music, hard rock, soft rock, intermediate rock, pebble rock. How are you going to interpret? How are you going to interpret? How are you going to interpret what you hear and see on the TV? The question is, you see, how are you going to evaluate modern democratic thought, political, social, economic, in terms of your Christian theology? This is what people are doing. This is what Jerry Falwell is trying to do today. This is what Francis Schaeffer did so successfully. And the church, down through the ages, always had to do this. Now, we call this apologetics. Well, it comes from the Greek word apologia, or apologeo, which means to speak in behalf of. We use the word apologetics today. I say, I apologize to you for something I've done. And the implication is that I've done something wrong and I need to make it right with you. Well, now, that is not the basic meaning of the word apologetics. It's a Greek word, apologeo. That means to speak in behalf of or to defend. And so, a great branch of Christian theology is apologetic. By the way, our friend lady, you're Mrs. Would you care to raise questions? I can't believe that a lady doesn't have questions.
I came in the middle of the class.
I realize
that.
your husband told me not to wait. He thought it'd take you about a half hour. You fooled me.
Well, no, I didn't have to wait. No, I'm sure I have
to wait. And I throw the floor open to you. What's your first name, Barbara?
Kathy.
Yeah. I understand you're a computer expert.
No. Don't spread more rumors. Yes, I work with
programs. Also, you speak Spanish fluently. You spoke with
her? No. Well, so far, I was wondering when you were talking about people coming to venerate the martyrs.
Yeah.
It would seem to me that might have become more popular once Christians weren't persecuted, because then you would have a less strong body of believers.
Well, it did. As the theology of the church deteriorated, you're quite right in your evaluation. And it became the scourge of the Middle Ages. Now, really, when you start to think about it, let me go back to this before I take this up the topic. What in our present Christian culture comes close to being the veneration of relics and the saints?
Humanism.
Yes, but it's
you mean like a martyrism?
No.
Well, we tend to venerate people like Billy Graham.
Oh, now you go.
Instead of
Billy Graham's a friend of mine, so anything I say is not being true to his personal criticism. It might be a criticism of people who are guilty of, not he, not of him. I don't know about your churches. I've been in many churches where they have Hoffman pictures of Christ floating around the wall. Hoffman pictures of Christ. Do you know that famous portrait?
Yeah, the real suffering.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Portrait.
And just the head of Christ.
Yeah.
He has several different types. Now,
apparently you haven't seen the woman.
No, thank you. No. we tend to venerate living, quote, saints, unquote. Now, I'm not defending the early church. I'm not defending the Roman church. But we're not entirely immune to it. I've seen oodles of Sunday school literature books, for particularly for young kids with pictures of Christ in them. Haven't you? Maybe you haven't. Haven't you, Bill?
Sunday
school? Yeah, quarterly, that sort of thing. Yes, adorned with pictures. Here. Now, You say it, Tom. Maybe it is. Well, the point I'm getting at is this, that it is a visual education of a type. Now let me make a point here. The church, when the barbarians invaded the empire, they faced a tremendous problem. The barbarians, except possibly for the West Guards of West Franks, were not able to read. We today don't really understand or evaluate the great problems the church faced. As the Roman Empire was inundated by the Vandals, the Burgundians, the East Goths, the West Goths, the Franks, the Angles, the Saxons, and so on, so was the church. Now, you couldn't leave Gospels of John in motel rooms or New Testament a la the Gideons. There were no motels, and more to the point, the people could have read if they had. So what did the church do? Right. It used visual education. A great deal of what became the use of martyrs, images and relics and stuff, was really crude, perhaps, but it was a form of visual education. And we, to a great extent, are doing the same thing in our Sunday school literature and in churches.
Well, is this going back to, well, not jumping back to like last night, what you're saying, because like the decline of education, of reading and writing,
sure.
That mm-hmm. we feel like we have to go back?
Yes. For a long time, I used a very good history of Western civilization put out by the great publishing company up in Boston, and I used it when I was teaching freshman courses, I used it probably for 8 or 10 years, maybe 6 or 7. And finally, the price went up, and the content went down, and had more and more pictures. And finally, because I was a good customer,
like
U.S. Mail. Yeah, the salesman came in one day and said, I can't use the book anymore. He said, why not? He pulled out his record. I ordered for the whole department maybe 150 copies of Cementive, which was a good order. A $10 copy meant $1,500, $3,000 from one school at 1 year. And I said, well, I said, you have more and more pictures at higher hiring costs and much less content. He looked at me and said, you're right. I said, how do you explain? He said, it's geared to the incoming college freshman who can't read. I had the same experience in my advanced course. I used a book called The Growth of the American Republic by Samuel Eliot Marsh and Henry Condit. It was undoubtedly, in its earlier editions, the best two-volume text available. Gradually it went down. Less text, more pictures. Of course, the pictures are expensive. Same thing. This is for college students.
You're not trying to connect this with the veneration of relics in the early
church. In this sense, I am. In fact, the college textbooks today are dealing in visual education. And the early church, particularly after the barbarian invasion, had the problem of dealing with visual education. And the church has far better reason or excuse for it than we do, because the barbarians simply couldn't read. So what did you do? You visualized the whole gospel story. Now I'm not, it was wrong. All I'm saying is, I can understand it.
Well, at that particular time, that would be the only way. Would they either have somebody sit around and tell stories?
Well, that's the question. Some of them did it. But it was the problem was mass evangelism.
Yeah.
Rather than one-to-one or two-to-two, rather than the biblical method, they indulged in mass evangelism. Now, Having gone through that point, let me go back to my main point again. The problem which these men acutely faced was the problem of how to address classic culture. How do you evaluate what is the Christian message to be in terms of classic culture? Now let me show you why it was constantly in the thinking of the church. And it was. The reason is this, and very simply, the early leaders of the church, once you get past the apostolic period, were either well trained in Roman classical culture, if you were in the western part of the church, or they were equally well trained, perhaps even better trained, if they came out of the Greek speaking part of the church. In other words, you take the fathers of the second and third century. They were trained as heathen Greek scholars, trained in Greek philosophy, trained in all the heathen pagan concepts of Greek thought. I'm thinking particularly of Justin Martyr, who about the age of 35 was converted. A brilliant scholar, well trained in classical thought. What's he going to do? Is he going to surrender his entire classical training and say, I bid you a fond farewell? Or is he going to try and find some way of finding a harmony between classical culture and Christianity? Or is he going to set out on the task of interpreting all of classical culture in terms of Christian doctrine? You see the three approaches? One, amalgamation or synergism, bring the two together.